This is Paula. Today I'm going to be reading a variety of articles for you from the Christian Science Monitor, dated Friday, May the 29th, 2026. As is my custom, we'll start in the world section of today's monitor and work our way through as many sections and articles as we can in the time that we have. So, to start us off from the world section today, our first headline reads, How Norway is Solving All the World's Problems with Waffles. Norway is one of the countries that is ranked highest in terms of community. It is events like Dugnads that might be helping bolster that mindset. The date on this article is May the 28th. It is by Mark Sappenfield, who is the senior global correspondent at The Monitor, and the dateline is Oslo, Norway. There is no precise word in English for what Anne Helen Marvold is doing. Volunteering perhaps comes closest, but it's more than that. She has not come to this part of suburban Oslo just to beautify the stream Gjersrudbekken on its forested tumble towards the fjord. She has come for some deeply ingrained Norwegian sense of obligation, of community, of responsibility, and of course, for the waffles. True, what she is doing looks remarkably like a run-of-the-mill cleanup, removing everything from car tires to motorized scooters from the stream's path, with a sweet treat for everyone afterwards. But she and her friends from a nearby university have been doing things like this since kindergarten, cleaning neighborhoods and holding bake sales to fund sports teams. Dugnad is not just the activity, but the mindset behind it. And at a time when social scientists see the fabric of society's fraying, churches and community organizations declining, connections across demographic lines dwindling, Dugnads are something of an antidote. No one here would argue that Dugnads are the reason why Norway consistently ranks as one of the highest trusted countries in the world. But no one would argue that they don't play a role either. They are a binding force, both simple and sweeping, that give Norwegians not only a sense of doing good, but of doing it together. When you're brought up, it's a big thing to go out and clean and make it look nice, says Miss Marvold. You start at a young age and you just learn to do it and love it. You see it as team building. The tradition has its roots in Norway's history as a poor nation of small farmers and fishermen. When a church or bridge needed to be built or a neighbor was building a barn, everyone came together to help. It was a kind of social insurance or a mobilizing of resources, and it was steeped in a sense of justice, says Carl Henrik Sivesind, a professor at the Institute for Social Research in Oslo, who has studied the tradition. It's not for your own advantage. You chip in, and everyone chips in. Today, social scientists lament the loss of social capital, the connections in a community that drive trust and bring broader benefits for all. The Dugnad is an incubator of social capital, Dr. Sivesind says. If you look at the word itself, it has a social element, he says, noting that its verbal roots reference the concept of virtue. You contribute to necessities of organization, and you meet people, build networks, and get to know people in your neighborhood. The Gjersrudbekken cleanup is organized by Ruskin, a three-person bureau in the Oslo city government that organizes volunteer cleanups and is celebrating its 50th anniversary this year. Ms. Mervold signed up with several friends who attend the nearby Norwegian University of Life Sciences and are part of a group called Feminine and Class. It sounds better in Norwegian, laughs Sanne Marie Tamlag Froland, a volunteer and member of the group. In addition to participating in Dugnads, they raise money for charitable causes. Right now, they're supporting a group providing the healthcare relief in Africa. To all the young women clad in bright orange vests and industrial work gloves participating in a Dugnad, it's just part of being Norwegian. and it usually involves an element of fun, whether that's waffles for mud-splattered workers or a cookout for kids. Across town, Norway's biggest hiking and outdoor activities organization is holding a dugnag of its own, skewers for sausages included. The Norwegian Trekking Association is among the most beloved groups in the country, maintaining trails and cabins for a nation of nature lovers. Today, in a playground of the residential neighborhood of Bærum, they've built a bonfire. The plan is to teach local children wilderness skills such as first aid. Many kids have brought stuffed animals to practice on, but it's also a chance for neighbors to meet and talk. As parents and children gather around the bonfire, sausages sizzle, and the red-vested volunteers mill about, chatting and preparing the presentation, which is free to anyone who wants to come. Maria Rud has brought her 7-year-old daughter. She says she's been doing these sorts of things forever. Local carnivals for kids, neighborhood cleanups, where you find a task the kids can do, and Norway's famous May 17th Independence Day celebrations, all made possible by dugnags. She acknowledges that she sometimes doesn't look forward to the work, whether that's planning games and food or raking leaves. But there's a bigger benefit. The good part is the social side, Ms. Rud says. You come together and share the work. As humans, you feel like you're part of something bigger. We need that to make our lives meaningful. That need is only becoming more important, some say. Kristen Sandaker ticks off the dugnags she's done over the years. At one flea market to support a local youth orchestra, she recalls getting in 24,000 steps simply lugging items around. I can say that was one of the year's best hikes, she grins. But she worries that the forces that would divide Norway are growing. The political polarization that shapes much of European politics has a foothold in Norway, too. And immigration can inadvertently raise the risks of different communities becoming detached and distant from one another. Dugnags are a counterbalance. There is a fellowship that comes from taking 24,000 steps or being ankle-deep in mud with someone. It is the most obvious proof that we can do things together, Ms. Sandaker says. With the current state of things, this gets even more important, that people get together in this way. And again, this particular article is by Mark Sappenfield, who is the senior global correspondent at The Monitor. Continuing on to our second headline from today's World section of The Monitor, it reads, in Nairobi, passengers queue for cheaper, quieter electric rides. The popularity of electric vehicles is growing quickly in Kenya, led by exponential growth in the sale and use of electric motorcycles. The date on this article is May 28th. It is by Vincent Owino, who is a contributor at The Monitor, and the dateline is Nairobi, Kenya. Every evening, Anne Kituku queues at a streetside bus park in central Nairobi, waiting for a bus to take her to her home in the eastern part of the Kenyan capital. Nearby, a rainbow of neon-colored matatus, minibuses, emblazoned with graffiti art and blasting loud music, quickly fill and depart in clouds of gritty exhaust. But Miss Kituku waits until a sleek, white electric bus silently glides up beside her. For Miss Kituku, who makes 16,000 Kenyan shillings, about $123 monthly, working as a cleaner, the decision to take the electric bus comes down to cost. The fare is 10 to 20 Kenyan shillings, that's 8 to 15 cents, less than their gas-powered counterparts, depending on the route, a saving that adds up significantly over the course of a month. Fuel prices in Kenya have risen nearly 40% since 2022, driven by Russia's invasion of Ukraine and, more recently, the war in Iran. The latest surge, in turn, has pushed matatu operators to raise fares by 25%. In mid-May, protests flared in Nairobi and a public transport strike over record high fuel prices. However, over the last 4 years, electric alternatives have also quietly begun appearing on Nairobi's streets. According to government figures, between 2022 and 2025, the number of EVs in the country rose from less than 800 to nearly 25,000, a 32-fold increase. Kenya, like much of Africa, is in an early phase of adopting electric vehicles. Its government was one of the few on the continent to sign an international pledge to have 100% of new vehicle sales fully electric by 2040. Analysts see transport electrification in Kenya, and Nairobi in particular, as a key way to both lower costs for consumers and help address urban pollution. Government policies, waiving import duties on parts and offering cheap electricity tariffs for EV charging, are speeding their adoption. Some researchers have suggested that transforming the informal transport sector in Kenya, the matatus that Ms. Kituku takes and boda-boda motorcycle taxis that shuttle many commuters around town, is one of the best ways to shift towards electrification. Indeed, unlike in Europe and North America, where cars dominate the electric market, in Kenya, two-wheelers are king. At least 90% of registered EVs here are motorbikes, and they now make up 40% of all boda-bodas registered on the ride-hailing app Bolt. For Jacob Sikunye, who makes his living as a boda-boda driver, the decision to switch was obvious. He says he now spends one-third as much on charging as he previously did on petrol. That makes it possible for him to charge 10 to 20% less for the same ride. Still, the cost savings are not as straightforward as they might appear. The purchase price of Mr. Sikunyi's electric motorbike was twice the cost of one with a combustion engine, an expense invisible to his customers. The cost of electric vehicles has been a barrier to their adoption worldwide. In the United States, for instance, new EVs can cost thousands of dollars more than their combustion engine competitors. But lower-cost electric vehicles, particularly those made in China, are starting to change that. China now has the world's largest market share of EVs, and Southeast Asian countries that import those cheaper Chinese vehicles are some of the world's fastest adopters. Most of Kenya's electric vehicles come from China, although rather than fully built cars, the country tends to import kits to build those vehicles locally. EV proponents point out that even if there is a higher upfront sticker price, it's less expensive to maintain and fuel an electric. That can be a double-edged sword for entrepreneurs such as Mr. Sikunyi. People already believe that electric is cheaper, he explains. He says that if he tries to offer a fare comparable to what the customers would pay for a standard boda-boda, they just wave him off. In the case of buses, the difference upfront cost is even greater. George Githinji, who operates a fleet of electric matatus, says the price of those buses was about seven times as much as what he would pay for combustion engine buses. Though electric bus manufacturers here offer leasing models that lower the upfront cost, Mr. Githinji says the difference is still stark. Even with savings on fuel and maintenance, he estimates the operating cost of electric and combustion engine buses are similar. Drop is basically negligible, he explains. Charging is also becoming costlier as more electric buses take to the roads without a proportionate growth in charging infrastructure. Electric buses cost 73 shillings, or about 56 cents per kilometer to charge, up by 16% since 2022. And unlike a petrol tank, which can be filled in minutes, bus batteries take as much as 2 hours to charge. But Mr. Githinji and other electric bus operators say they aren't depending only on lower prices to attract customers. The buses are also newer, quieter, and have more predictable fares and schedules. A smartphone app also allows riders to pay fares before boarding and see exactly when their bus will arrive. We're investing in the efficiency and comfort because we're not sure if it'll be possible to offer better prices for long, explains Mr. Githinji. It may soon be all that's keeping customers. And once again, this particular article was by Vincent Owingo, who is a contributor at the Monitor. Moving on, still in the world section of today's Monitor, our next headline reads, Manila unrest signals new attention to an old problem, political dynasties. A new people's initiative aiming to limit political dynasties is inspiring hope that the Philippines' 2028 election could look different. The date on this article is May the 28th. It is by Mark Saludis, who is a contributor at the Monitor, and the dateline is Manila, Philippines. The collapse of one of the most formidable political alliances in modern Philippine history has brought new scrutiny to the country's deeply entrenched dynasties. President Ferdinand Marcos Jr. and Vice President Sara Duterte, scions of two of the most powerful and controversial families in the Philippines, joined forces in 2022, clinching a landslide election victory and consolidating their influence across the archipelago. But the partnership began to fray amid growing policy disagreements and competing political ambitions ahead of the 2028 presidential election. Tensions culminated this month when Ms. Duterte, whose father, former President Rodrigo Duterte, is under investigation by the International Criminal Court for his deadly drug war, was impeached on charges of corruption and threatening the life of her former ally. Analysts say the family is now in survival mode, but for the Filipino public, it's just another twist in a long-running plot. Even if this turmoil topples the vice president, there will likely be another Duterte to fill the void, or a Marcos, or any rising star from another one of the dozen or so uber-powerful political families that dominate local and national politics here in the Philippines. Indeed, the Philippines is widely considered the world's most dynastic democracy, with the Philippine Center for Investigative Journalism reporting that political dynasties controlled 87% of provinces, 83% of legislative districts, and 75% of cities in 2025. Congress has failed to tackle the issue, which has eroded democratic norms and institutions. Now, Filipinos are taking matters into their own hands. Earlier this month, several Catholic and civil society groups launched a campaign to bypass Congress and enact an anti-dynasty law through a rarely used democratic mechanism known as a people's initiative. The movement, called Dapat Isa Lang, there should only be one, must gather roughly 7 million signatures by October to advance its proposed legislation, which would limit a family's ability to hold multiple offices simultaneously or rotate positions among relatives. The Reverend Robert Reyes, a Catholic priest and one of the campaign's conveners, says elections in the Philippines are no longer about choosing qualified candidates, but rather a regular distribution of favors every 3 years to people who depend on dynasties. Our country will not develop or move forward as long as this culture and system of governance remains unchanged, he says. This is not just about Marcos versus Duterte. This is about all dynasties whose only concern is self-preservation and survival. The Philippine Constitution, ratified in 1987 following the fall of Fernando Marcos Sr.'s dictatorship, explicitly orders the state to prohibit political dynasties, but Congress has never passed legislation to enforce that. Most members of Congress come from political families, says Carlos Conde, an independent human rights researcher and editor of Rights Report Philippines. You could not find a more perfect case study showing why political dynasties in the Philippines are so problematic. This problem is not unique to the Philippines. Across South Asia, powerful families dominate political systems where democratic institutions are weak, patronage networks are deeply entrenched, and family names often serve as the most durable political brands. The Shinawatra family has remained central to Thai politics despite clashes with the country's military establishment. Indonesian President Prabowo Subianto married into the family of longtime authoritarian ruler Suharto. From Pakistan to Bangladesh, certain names, the Sharifs, Nehru Gandhis, Sheikh Wazeds, have loomed large for decades. These families tend to concentrate authority within a narrow elite circle, and that's certainly true in the Philippines. According to an analysis, at least 18, quote, obese political dynasties or clans with five or more members in office were elected last year. Leo Angelo Pascua, a political and electoral campaign strategist in the Bilcol region, says that part of the reason political dynasties flourish in the Philippines is that national parties remain weak and transactional. High-level alliances, including the Marcos Duterte partnership, are rarely built on shared values, but rather on resources and patronage, and politicians frequently switch parties depending on who's in power. This also leads to an abundance of smaller provincial parties. Strategists like me advise governors to insulate themselves from unstable national parties, he says. The thinking is, let's unite locally, build our own party, and then negotiate with whoever on the national level can give us the most resources. In return, we deliver the votes. Especially in poorer provinces, political families often become the primary intermediaries between citizens and the state, shaping access to jobs, public services, and local resources. People clearly see that, says Mr. Pascua. They feel the need, they feel the effects in their lives. If passed, the Dapat Isa Lang proposal would fundamentally alter the structure of Philippine electoral politics. Only two members of a political family could hold elected office at any given time, one in a national position and one local. The measure would also prohibit succession, substitution, and switching of positions among relatives up to the fourth degree of consanguinity, including first cousins. But first, organizers must mobilize a network of churches, schools, and civic organizations to gather millions of signatures, 10% of the national voting pool, which must then be verified by the Commission on Elections in order to trigger a referendum. The People's Initiative will likely face legal and political challenges before reaching a national plebiscite. These political dynasties hold not only political power, but also economic power. They control vast resources and maintain close ties with the business and financial sectors, Mr. Pascua says. The push for a national referendum requires a significant amount of funding. Can the Catholic Church and civil society sustain that? The Reverend Reyes hopes it can. In the end, Dapat Isa Lang may be a litmus test for the Catholic Church's political influence in the Philippines, which is about 79% Catholic. The movement presents itself as a broad civic campaign, bringing together former government officials, social justice groups, and business leaders, but bishops and other clergy members are at the helm, framing dynastic corruption as a moral issue. The Church has opposed dynasties in the past, including in 2022, when a contingent of clergy and lay leaders tried unsuccessfully to steer the public away from returning the Marcos family to Malacanang. For many, that election was a wake-up call, revealing how decades of political neutrality had sapped the Church of its authority. Some view this push for anti-dynasty reform as a less partisan and polarizing means to a similar end. So far, it seems to be resonating with congregations. After the movement was launched on May 8th, many bishops even invited us to go to their diocese to speak to the clergy and explain to ordinary people why dynasties are a problem, says the Reverend Reyes. Once the context is clear, followers, and especially young people, are eager to be part of the solution. Molly Espinoza, a newly registered voter raised in a Catholic family, is adding her voice to what she describes as the growing clamor for change. I can't imagine a future still trapped in the same problem the country is experiencing now, she says. I don't want my future self to be governed by the same family names my parents rant and complain about every single day. That's why I think it is really important for young people to step forward and make the right move. And once again, this particular article was by Mark Saludis, who is a contributor at The Monitor. Still in the world section of today's Monitor, our next headline reads, amid concerns U.S.-Iran deal could falter, Mideast powers push it forward. Mixed signals surround the U.S.-Iran negotiations, but a bloc of Mideast middle powers is assertively pushing for a ceasefire. The date on this article is May the 26th. It is by Taylor Luck, who is a special correspondent at the Monitor, and the datelines are Abu Dhabi, United Arab Emirates, Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, and Amman, Jordan. The Middle East is lurching between hope and apprehension over a potential U.S.-Iran agreement to end the conflict, as new strikes, threats of retaliation, and leaks from the talks signal that any deal might collapse before it is even signed. At the center is a framework that officials from both the United States and Iran acknowledge is progressing, a memorandum of understanding outlining their intention to end the dueling blockades of the Strait of Hormuz, suspend hostilities, and enter talks into a more enduring agreement. According to leaks, the Pakistan-brokered memorandum will formalize a cessation of hostilities for 60 days, extending a ceasefire agreed to on April 8th, during which the United States and Iran would enter direct talks on the future of Iran's nuclear program, the fate of its enriched uranium, and other thorny issues. An upbeat Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio, said over the weekend that he expected the deal to be announced by President Donald Trump first late Sunday and then Monday. Yet, as of Tuesday, no formal announcement had been made, and Mr. Rubio said the deal would take a few days. The president's expressed his desire to make it. He's either going to make a good deal or no deal, Mr. Rubio told reporters in India on Tuesday. Despite the reported progress on a deal, the U.S. launched new strikes in southern Iran Tuesday, targeting what U.S. Central Command described as missile sites and boats attempting to plant mines. It was reported later in the day that the U.S. Navy had resumed its assistance to ships navigating the Strait of Hormuz. Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman Esmail Baghai warned that though progress had been made, a deal is not imminent. One of the outstanding issues, according to the FARS news agency media outlet, which is affiliated with the powerful Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, is the U.S. release of frozen Iranian funds. Quoting an informed source in Iran's negotiating team, FARS stated that no agreement is possible until the agreed-upon funds have been deposited. Given America's history of breaking promises, Iran does not consider these understandings finalized. FARS noted that progress had been made on the issue during talks in Doha, Qatar. As a memorandum of understanding was still taking shape Monday, President Trump suddenly added a new condition that created a significant hurdle. In a social media post, he demanded that the Gulf countries and Pakistan mediating an end to the conflict must also join the Abraham Accords as a condition to Washington agreeing to the memorandum. The breakthrough accords, first signed in 2020 by the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain, and later expanded, normalized diplomatic, security, and economic ties between the signatories and Israel. Even if a deal fails to materialize, one clear development is the growing collective sway of middle powers in the Middle East. The efforts of Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Qatar, Bahrain, Kuwait, Turkey, Pakistan, and Jordan, all name-checked by Mr. Trump, to push forward a deal seen as in their common interest, highlighted the increasing influence of Middle Eastern states working to keep the region stable. The bloc includes the world's top energy producers, a NATO member in Turkey, and a nuclear power in Pakistan. It also includes the Gulf Arab owners of sovereign wealth funds with a collective $5 trillion that invest in the U.S. and Europe. Excuse me. Coinciding with the bloc's rise, Israel reportedly has been increasingly sidelined in the Trump administration's deliberations on how and when to end the war with Iran, which started on February 28th with joint U.S.-Israeli airstrikes. Gulf Arab states, which were not a party to the war and sought to prevent violence from breaking out in January and February, have been hardest hit, absorbing thousands of Iranian retaliatory missiles and drones. In what is seen as a sign of progress, Qatar, whose economy has been severely weakened by the Hormuz blockade, hosted Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi and the lead Iranian negotiator, Parliamentary Speaker Mohammed Bagher Khalibaf, in Doha on Monday. Qatar, a leading mediator of conflicts around the world, had previously stepped back from mediating between Washington and Tehran after being targeted by Iran. The bloc's mediation reflects the growing role of regional and middle powers in promoting de-escalation and facilitating dialogue, particularly in conflicts where the region itself bears the greatest consequence, says Khalid Al-Jaber, executive director of the Doha-based Middle East Council on Global Affairs. Their priority will not be to declare victory, but to prevent renewed escalation and ensure that the region is not left exposed to another cycle of confrontation, he adds. And yet, Gulf states are sending a signal they are ready to act militarily should Iran once again target them to pressure the U.S. and inflict pain on the global economy. I believe Gulf states are trying to tell Iran for the second time, we did our best to stop a war against you, but there is no justification for Iran to attack us again. If you do, we will be in our right to respond militarily, says Muhannad Saloom, assistant professor of international politics and security at the Doha Institute for Graduate Studies. They are doing their best to prevent war, as this is in everyone's interest, but at the same time, they are preparing for whatever war is coming, Dr. Saloom said. The push by President Trump to transform any Iran-U.S. agreement to make it a part of an expanded Abraham Accords added a new wrinkle to regional diplomacy. The UAE, an initial signatory, has tightened cooperation with Israel throughout the war, with Israel deploying missile defense systems to the Federation of Emirates. Emirati officials and observers say the UAE is doubling down on its ties with Israel as part of its diverse range of alliances regionally and globally. Yet for Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Pakistan, and others, the time for full ties with Israel is not yet right. In interviews, multiple Gulf officials have repeatedly said they are ready to normalize ties with Israel should it moderate its destabilizing behavior and end aggressive military policies they believe have incited an expanded conflict in Lebanon, Syria, and Iran. These states are also seeking steps from Israel to reverse what many regard as ethnic cleansing and annexation in the West Bank and Gaza, with the view that the lack of Palestinian rights and statehood will continue to fuel regional instability. Israel is turning inward and lashing out, but no one is thinking about living with its neighbors, a Gulf official recently told the Christian Science Monitor, referring to both Israeli government policy and opposition statements. The official did not want to reveal their nationality or position, as they were not authorized to speak on behalf of their leader. Israel is not ready for normalization, but we hope it becomes ready for the sake of the region, the official said. There is also a concern among Gulf officials that entering a normalization pact with Israel now would make it appear as though the region is coalescing around an Israeli axis. That would signal to Iran that the bloc of states is formally becoming a front to counter Tehran, leading to further escalation and war. Instead, Gulf states, with the exception of the UAE, believe that the future requires managing relations with a wounded but defiant Iranian regime, a neighbor with whom they must live alongside long after the current conflict ends and America turns its attention elsewhere. But even if an eventual memorandum and a U.S.-Iran agreement end the current war, regional officials see no clear victor. The memorandum may provide a basis for ending active hostilities, but it should not be mistaken for a comprehensive resolution, warns Dr. Al-Jaber. All parties have absorbed costs, and none have achieved a decisive strategic outcome. And once again, this particular article was by Taylor Luck, who is a special correspondent at The Monitor. And here's one final article from today's World section of The Monitor. The headline reads, Voices from Havana, Cubans offer their thoughts about the future of the island. The Trump administration is looking to impose big changes on Cuba. What's at stake for the people who live there? The date on this article is May 26. It is by Whitney Ulick, who is a special correspondent at the Monitor, and Ruby Cabrera Arcia, who is a special contributor at the Monitor. The dateline is Mexico City and Havana. The United States is turning up the heat on Cuba, renewing threats of military action and casting doubt on the possibility of reaching a diplomatic solution to a decades-long stalemate. Cuba announced that its oil reserves have been exhausted due to a U.S. blockade on the island. As many as 2 million Cubans are believed to have fled the country over the past 5 years as the tourism-dependent economy struggled in the wake of the COVID-19 pandemic and the government violently cracked down on public protests over food shortages. In recent months, electric outages have become a fact of life in Cuba. Food is rotting in refrigerators, student schools and bus routes have limited service, and members of the public are speaking up saying they have had enough. The U.S. unsealed criminal charges against former President Raul Castro on May 20th for his alleged orders to shoot down 2 civilian aircraft flown by Miami-based exiles in 1996. Mr. Castro, along with his late brother Fidel, led the Cuban Revolution that overthrew a dictator in 1959 and ushered in a communist government that has endured since the 1960s. The Trump administration has made repeated comments in recent months about the need for leadership change on the island. Currently, the only thing standing in the way of a better future are those who control your country, Secretary of State Marco Rubio told the population in a Spanish-language video released on Cuban Independence Day last week. President Donald Trump touted what he sees as his role in Cuban history, saying U.S. leaders have sought a Cuban transformation for 6 decades, and it, quote, it looks like I'll be the one to do it. But what do Cubans want? How eager are they for seismic political change? Also, what aspects of life in Cuba, even under a communist government, do they want to preserve in the future? The Christian Science Monitor spoke with several Cubans living in Havana from their early 30s to their late 80s about their hopes and fears for what comes next on the island. Here are some of their perspectives on this moment in their own voices. The first is a spirit of perseverance. Sheila Rivero, in her early 30s, is a technology specialist in Cuba's state sector. She lives in the capital with her young daughter alongside her parents, brother, and sister-in-law. She's deeply religious, and a few international travel experiences over the years have made her yearn for a different kind of life in Cuba, replete with freedom, dignity, and possibility, she says. And here's what she says. Cuba has always been synonymous with happiness, simplicity, camaraderie, delicious food, and music, rhythm in general. But above all, for me, it's characterized by a spirit of perseverance. But that was the Cuba of my past. Today, it's falling apart. It feels sad, lifeless, hopeless. Its music is no longer what it used to be. Marginality has suppressed our rich culture. We no longer get to enjoy our good food. We aren't even cheerful people anymore. And our long history of having a helping spirit is at risk of disappearing into a save-yourself-if-you-can mentality. Everyone is just trying to survive. I like to imagine a prosperous Cuba, healed and restored cities, freedom of the press, freedom of expression, real true private enterprise, music made without censorship. As a mother, I want a country where my daughter can dream. I dream of a Cuba where she will want to stay, where she can live on a decent wage. From the government, I want one thing, that it actually works, that politicians are accountable and leaders are chosen through free election, serve their terms, and actually deliver on their promises. For communists to be something that only lives in the history books. Communism, excuse me. My fear is that all of this from the United States will amount to nothing more than a media spectacle, that whatever agreements are reached will solve absolutely nothing. And what truly terrifies me is the possibility that a bombardment could break out here, ultimately claiming the lives of innocent people. especially when you consider that the militarized zones within the city are close to schools, residential areas, and various workplaces. So that's her thought. The next one is the very essence of being Cuban. Ivan Luis Arcia is an engineer who specializes in mental processing. Several years ago, he started his own car repair business. Although he considers himself an entrepreneur, investing in a piece of private land to set up his workshop, his work still relies on the Cuban government. The way things are now is not how they will remain. I follow the news. A post-Trump Cuban society would be like Switzerland or Costa Rica or Germany, because with the capital that will be invested in Cuba, a country that has the potential to grow exponentially, change will arrive in the blink of an eye. You can ask any Cuban on the street. You don't have to go looking for them. I was at the bank today, and there was this really long line, and someone shouted, "Hey, we really need Trump to get here already." And everyone started laughing. I mean, we're waiting for the United States. It's an open secret. We have our hopes pinned on Trump. But my fears? I fear that with an economic opening, things like guns and crime could flood in. I also fear that someone like me, who has spent his entire life in Cuba working hard and pushing ahead, might suddenly see someone else arrive with less knowledge but more resources. I'm an engineer. I've spent my life studying, yet someone could come along with $40,000 or $50,000 and make an investment that leaves me without the capital to compete. Here I am, someone who stuck it out, and then I'd have to work for them. Anyone with even a little capital is going to grab the biggest slice of the pie. I believe we need to set a quota, not necessarily a hard limit on investments, but specifically on foreign investments. Just consider an average person in the rest of the world and the savings or loans they have access to. That's the fear, that Cubans might be relegated to the background while some foreigner comes along and leapfrogs right in front of us. If our country ends up parceled out among people who aren't Cuban, their very essence of being Cuban will be lost. And a third opinion from the locals in Cuba. The title is Total Abandonment. El Chino Libre, a Havana resident of Chinese descent, asked us to use his nickname out of fear of reprisals for sharing his feelings about this moment in Cuba. The professional chef tried dabbling in small entrepreneurial restaurant projects over the past decade, but each shuttered, he says, due to arbitrary obstacles and regulations placed on Cuba's small private sector by the government. More recently, he has tried to make ends meet by catering for special events, including at various embassies on the island. Cuba is its people, he says, but we're a people who are exhausted. In the past, you might hear people talking about joy and music and the warmth of Cuban people. That's still here, but it's not the same. We have to wake up every day figuring out how to scrape together a meal, survive without electricity. I fear our essence as a people is slowly wearing away. I don't expect saviors, and certainly not saviors coming from outside Cuba. But what is clear to me is that we also can't keep using outside factors as an excuse for everything that's happening here, saying, oh, it's all because of the embargo. That isn't the whole story. My fear is that everything will remain exactly the same as it was and has been, that there will be no change, and that we will continue to justify the unjustifiable here. But I also have hope, including that there will be no way left to keep ignoring our struggles, that things will begin to flow freely. This notion that everyone should have access to health care, to education, it's only fair in theory. It's something that any country, including the United States, should probably aspire to guarantee. But the problem arises when that idea evolves into a system that controls everything. It becomes a system that limits opportunities and prevents growth. And so then it ceases to be real. Access to schools or medical care is meaningless if the quality of services are in a state of decay, if doctors, professionals, and teachers lack the proper working conditions. This shouldn't be about idealizing a concept or demonizing it. We have to look at the whole picture. When the power goes out in Cuba, I just sit here. I try to stay calm, and I wait. I start thinking about what this actually represents. When the power goes out, it's not just a blackout. What I feel is total abandonment on the part of my government. And last but not least, a zest for life. Zoila Caridad Gonzalez recently became a great grandmother. She said she would love to dote on her growing family, but that she spends a large chunk of her time instead standing in line for medicine and state-rationed groceries. She speaks about Cuba as if she's reciting poetry, with rhythm, cadence, and emotion. Idiosyncrasy is the very essence of Cuba. We are gracious hosts. We're sincere. I want to see Cuba return to its full potential, a joyful, vibrant community with a zest for life. What I wish for most is democracy. It's fundamental to any government in the world. Cuba needs urgent change. It needs to uproot communism. The people themselves should decide our future. I have high hopes about the attention from the U.S. I have no concerns. How will the U.S. government go about it? Well, I don't think it could be any worse than this. And a note here at the bottom of this article, Whitney Ulick reported from Mexico City for this article, and Rudy Cabrera Arcia was from Havana, and they are both credited as writers of this particular article. With that, we're going to jump on over to the USA section of today's Monitor and pick up a headline or two. So, from the USA section, the first headline I've picked is, in Washington, a profound shift in how taxpayer money is spent. Will it last? President Donald Trump has worked to control more government spending as Congress has ceded some of its power of the purse. The change could create a new normal. The date on this article is May the 28th. It is by Caitlin Babcock, who is a staff writer at the Monitor, and the dateline is Washington, D.C. Just about anything a president wants to do, such as go to the war, start an infrastructure project, or strengthen law enforcement, requires financing from Congress. But increasingly, the government's money hasn't been going where Congress says it should. The Trump administration is using unprecedented tactics to test the boundaries of how it can control taxpayer money that Congress has budgeted, threatening one of Congress's core functions under the Constitution and one of its strongest checks on executive power. The efforts are a direct assertion of presidential power, often wielded in the name of taming wasteful spending. But the actions also reach into Congress itself. Under presidential pressure, Congress is slowly upending its own spending process, passing party-line bills that circumvent its normal bipartisan procedure, and giving presidents broader leeway. For example, Republicans hope to soon pass a bill that will fund federal immigration enforcement for years in advance. Supporters of President Donald Trump's policy say a president should be able to, for example, stop funds from going to countries that harm the United States' interest, or save money if Congress's goals can be accomplished with fewer funds than they laid aside. Still, the practice signals a profound shift in how money is spent, raising questions over how or whether taxpayers can hold the government accountable and whether more White House control over spending will become a new normal that permanently expands a president's powers. In Congress, even some members of President Trump's party aren't entirely comfortable with the transfer of spending authority. Retaining our constitutional authority has always been something that I see as important, and hopefully my colleagues do too. So I hope that we maintain a balance, says Republican Representative Dan Newhouse of Washington, who sits on the House Appropriations Committee, or else we become more or less irrelevant. David Super, a federal budget expert at Georgetown University Law Center, believes that actions over the past year show that the new normal is already here. This changes the funding process forever, he says. If Trump can do it, so can everyone else. The administration hasn't rejected Congress's budgetary authority wholesale, but since Mr. Trump's inauguration more than a year ago, his administration has unilaterally slashed some large categories of spending, such as the U.S. Agency for International Development, National Institute of Health, and the Department of Education. Mr. Trump and his executive branch have exerted the power to spend as well as cut in ways that Congress hasn't authorized. Emergency declarations over immigration and energy paved the way for sending military reservists to the southern border and promoting fossil fuel development. On some of its actions, the White House has come to Congress after the fact to seek legislative support. Other times, it has worked to undercut any legislative role. In August 2025, the President sent a request to Congress to cancel nearly $5 billion that Congress had directed be spent on foreign aid. The Impoundment Control Act says a president must give Congress 45 days to consider any such request, but the White House sent their letter just 30 days before the fiscal year ended. The administration touted this as something called a pocket rescission, a procedural loophole promoted by the White House budget director, Russell Vogt. The idea is that by submitting a request to cancel funding with only a few days left in the fiscal year, a president can effectively bypass Congress because the money simply lapses. A lawsuit seeking to block the maneuver went to the Supreme Court, which sided with the administration. The intended recipients of the relief funds never saw the money. Philip Joyce, a University of Maryland professor who researches public budgeting, says when actions like pocket rescissions get even a small sign-off from a court, it establishes them as options. That means that presidents have that power, not just this president. All future presidents have this power, says Dr. Joyce. That's not the only time the administration tried to withhold money Congress has set aside to be spent, a practice known as impoundment. The Trump White House has tested the limits of what constitutes impoundment by withholding grants and freezing or canceling programs it said conflicted with its priorities. Mr. Vogt has asserted that the Constitution doesn't require a president to spend every dollar that Congress appropriates. It's a ceiling, not a floor, he said at a July 2025 breakfast hosted by the Christian Science Monitor. Some Republicans in Congress make a similar case. Representative John Rutherford of Florida argues impoundment could be a useful tool in cases where, for example, Congress overestimates the amount of money it will take to complete a certain project, and a president doesn't need Congress's okay. He controls the executive branch, Representative Rutherford said. Another potential transformation in how Congress wields its power of the purse is coming from Congress itself. Each year, members approve agency budgets in what's known as the appropriations process, or the center of government, as Democratic Representative Rosa DeLauro of Connecticut, who is the ranking member of the House Appropriations Committee, puts it. But amid budgetary gridlock in recent decades, it's become increasingly common for parties in Congress to use a maneuver known as budget reconciliation in a novel way, to skirt that process when it comes to things they really want passed. These reconciliation bills, like the Republicans' 2025 tax and spending bill dubbed the One Big Beautiful Bill and Democrats' 2022 Inflation Reduction Act, are distinct in two key ways. They effectively don't require bipartisanship and can provide funding for a party's priorities for multiple years. That means that there's no annual evaluation of whether government spending is achieving its intended goals. Under the traditional funding process, says Professor Super, if programs have been inefficient or spending their resources on things that are not their job or corrupt, they face a lot of embarrassment and they face funding cuts. Some lawmakers worry about Congress growing too used to this alternative funding pathway. We certainly don't want to make it such that the way we get spending bills passed is exclusively through reconciliation, says Arkansas Republican John Boozman, a member of the Senate Appropriations Committee. The problem here is everything is done by precedent, so that gets to be easy, to be the easy way to do it. The Trump administration has taken some actions that make it difficult to untangle exactly how taxpayer money that's been budgeted by Congress is being spent. After Mr. Trump's first impeachment, in which he was accused of conditioning the release of congressionally approved money to pressure Ukraine, Congress passed a law requiring the Office of Management and Budget to make apportionment data public. That meant it had to disclose exactly how it parcels out congressionally approved funds to different agencies. In March 2025, the OMB deactivated its public apportionment website, saying it could reveal sensitive information. The office later complied with a court order to start reposting documents, although watchdog groups reported missing elements such as required footnotes. The administration has been fast and loose in terms of what they're making public and what they're not, says Dr. Joyce. The White House has also used money appropriated by Congress in novel ways that make it hard to track. During two recent government shutdowns, the Trump administration paid employees. Some legal experts said that was a kind of impoundment in reverse. Instead of the government refusing to spend money Congress had set aside, the government spends money that Congress hasn't set aside, at least not for that purpose. During the Department of Homeland Security shutdown that began February 2026, for example, the administration directed DHS employees to be paid with funds that had a reasonable and logical nexus to the function of DHS. That definition left it unclear exactly which funds the president was using to pay these workers and gave the administration, not Congress, wide leeway to decide what reasonable and logical meant. They were not at all clear about their legal justification, says Zachary Price, a professor at the University of California College of Law in San Francisco. The current Congress hasn't shown much inclination to claw back its power. And most experts predict that expanded presidential authority will carry into the future. It doesn't really matter whether that executive is a Democrat or a Republican, Dr. Joyce says. Once you've ceded power, once you've given power from the legislative branch to the executive branch, it's gone. Professor Super says it's possible the balance of power between Congress and the president swing back in the other direction. Once we get past President Trump, I suspect Congress will reassert itself and dramatically shrink the flexibility the administration has, he says. There's some historical precedent. The Nixon administration's use of expansive executive power led Congress to try to reassert its power. Congress passed laws, sometimes over the president's veto, to enforce its authority over things like decisions about military conflict and limiting how the president spends congressionally appropriated money. In the aftermath of Richard Nixon's resignation, Congress passed a series of reforms designed to promote ethics and transparency in government. Representative Mark Amode of Nevada, an Appropriations Committee member, says he doesn't necessarily see Mr. Trump's actions as opening the door for president's expanded use of controversial tools going forward, not if the Congress is zealous in protecting its Article I authority. Asked if Congress has been zealous enough so far, he replies, "We've had good days and bad days." And once again, this particular article was written by Caitlin Babcock, who is a staff writer at The Monitor. With that, I am afraid we have run out of time for today. As always, I appreciate you joining me to listen to a variety of articles from the Christian Science Monitor every week. Stay safe, stay well, stay hopeful. And I'm on vacation next week, but I should be back at the end of the week. As always, thank you for listening.